hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough.
Put on my blue suede shoes and I boarded the plane. Touchdown in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring rain.
Boy, are we in the Delta Blues or what? That was Mark Cohen and his famous song, Walking in Memphis. But we are certainly in the Delta Blues in terms of COVID-19. And since the last time you've listened to the McCullough Report, in the United States, we've shot from about 30% of all COVID-19 cases being the Delta variant. And now, as of July 17th, 2021 data, we're at 83% Delta variant. Never have we had such a giant shift in the proportion of strains of COVID-19 in the United States than in the last month. And the complexion has completely changed. Americans know this. We are in an upswing, an outbreak, if you will, of COVID-19 from a low baseline. We still are at about 10% of our overall caseload that we had at the peak of the pandemic back in December, but it still is an issue. Americans are falling sick with COVID-19 right now. In families and in groups of individuals, Americans recognize that about half of people getting COVID-19 have never had it before, and that half of them who are getting COVID-19 have had the vaccine. There's only one group that is not getting COVID-19 is that individuals who previously had it from another strain. So it appears as if COVID-19 natural immunity is the backstop. It is robust, it's complete, it's durable, and fortunately patients are not getting reinfected or a second infection with the Delta variant. But I wanted to update you with some critical information about what we know about the Delta variant. It has a total of 7 mutations, 3 critical ones in the spike protein. It builds upon a previous mutation that was part of the UK variant, and then the other mutations are elsewhere. And the virus is going through a process of what's called antibody escape or antigen minimalization. The spike protein is being changed to reduce its exposure to the antibodies that are being produced by the vaccines. And in a paper by Venkata Krishnan, 1.3 million genomes were analyzed from 178 countries. And it's clear, and there's a figure in this paper that demonstrates that the spike protein, in a sense, is which is the spine on the ball of the virus. It's not really a spine, by the way. Its conformation looks much different in terms of a real folded protein, but its conformation is changing in a way where the antibodies from the vaccine simply can't stick to the virus anymore, the Delta variant being the prototypic variant that's escaping mutation. So the right term is mutation. The COVID-19 is mutating or changing very rapidly, maybe more rapidly than a lot of viruses that we could expect. In a paper by Williams and colleagues from Lancet Respiratory Diseases in January of 2021, it really talked about the differences between antigenic drift, which is what we see in influenza with the hemagglutinin and neuraminidase proteins. They generally change by recombination, so each year the flu vaccine is reset. That is very different than what we're seeing now. We're seeing the virus basically change in order to avoid the effect of the vaccines. The vaccines, in fact, may be driving these proportional changes. And in an analysis by Neeson and colleagues, 1.8 million genomes, 183 countries, they did demonstrate that when 25% of the population gets a vaccine. This has happened two times now, some states in India with the CoronaVac vaccine, as well as in Peru with the CoronaVac vaccine. That's the whole virus killed vaccine. It appears to drive the predominance of a mutation. It doesn't cause a mutation. These variants are in the background, but it allows one to emerge to become the dominant variant. The one out of Peru is now named the Lambda variant. And then we see one coming out of California called the Epsilon variant, and that could be in response to use of Pfizer and Moderna, which are the predominant vaccines in the United States, to a lesser degree, Johnson & Johnson. But specifically with respect to Delta, in a paper appearing in New England Journal of Medicine July 21st of this year by Bernal from the United Kingdom, they analyzed patients who had received the vaccines, various vaccines, and the Delta variant compared to the Alpha variant or the United Kingdom variant. And conclusion here is that the virus seems to be coming and attacking individuals who have been vaccinated roughly at about 20 weeks after the vaccine. So that's coming out to be several months after vaccination. With the initial shot, the coverage or protection for the Delta variant was only about 30%. So this is very important. In the UK, they do use Pfizer and Moderna and AstraZeneca. So the first shot of one of the messenger RNA vaccines, watch out, you're still at risk. The second shot, the coverage or initial protection did rise to reasonable levels, nearly 90%. Now, it's difficult to calculate this when you don't have a placebo group, but there are reasonable ways to calculate this. What's always in the background, by the way, of the vaccinated and unvaccinated is the naturally immune, since none of the studies are really giving a fair coverage of the naturally immune. We can assume that the naturally immune is about 25% of those vaccinated. So with that, the Bernal paper took United Kingdom data up until May 31st. Well, the next thing that happened in the timeline was June 11th. And what happened there is the United Kingdom, in their variants under investigation report that they put out, for the first time reported what's called the Delta Plus variant. And the Delta Plus variant has an additional mutation, mutation 417N. And so this, again, the virus has mutated. So even the coverage that we expected from the New England Journal of Medicine paper, where the data ended May 31st, is almost certainly much less comprehensive than what was reported in that paper. And we're seeing several things happen. And so I wanted to point out three important events and then a paper. The first is a wedding in Houston, and it was a fully vaccinated wedding. And after the wedding was done, people dispersed, and then six people came down with COVID. Now, the requirements to go to the wedding was everybody in the family had to be vaccinated. Well, six people came down with COVID, and it was a question of, well, gosh, how could that have happened? And then on a British naval vessel, and this was on last week's McCullough report, a large British naval vessel, about 3,700 fully vaccinated shipmen went off to sea, and then about 100 came down with COVID. Well, how could that happen? And now we've heard about a private chartered plane flight with Democratic legislators. Everyone who got on the plane was fully vaccinated, and when they got off the plane, and then within a few hours or a day or so, several of the legislators came down with COVID-19. In fact, some of them met with our Vice President Kamala Harris. She had to go running for cover and get tested at a military medical center. And then a paper comes out from Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. And the first author is Fahrenholt. And in the title of the paper is the term Delta escape, and what the paper describes, and I think this is pretty solid, is that people who have been vaccinated are not only able to get a Delta variant, but they're also able to have it in their system and carry it and transmit it to someone else. And I think that's what happened on these three events that will probably be recorded as minor events in the COVID history, but they're the first ones to make us think that, you know what, the vaccines could be backfiring, that not only are they not protecting individuals from contracting COVID-19, but it may allow carriage, that is to have the virus, carry it, and then transmit it to another individual. So I think that clearly is particularly concerning. Well, we've seen a shift in the media cycles and the expression of the desires of the administration and what's happening. So this week, there was almost like a flurry of identical talking points that came out from the administration and quickly into the media that said the current outbreak was a crisis of the unvaccinated, that only the unvaccinated were getting COVID-19, that 99% of individuals hospitalized and who were dying of COVID-19. Now, we're at 10% of our baseline levels as from our peak, so we're at a small outbreak and we're up from a low baseline. But this is really not reconciled with Americans who are realizing that people who are vaccinated are clearly getting COVID-19. I'm seeing this in my practice. It's about half of cases have been previously vaccinated, half have not. How can this be a crisis of the unvaccinated? And it has to do with what's called asymmetric data reporting. Towards the end of April, the CDC had already had over 10,000 fully vetted breakthrough cases of COVID-19. Presumably that was with the Alpha variant and some of the earlier variants. That's before Delta even came on board. So we knew the vaccines were failing to some degree at that time. Those cases were pushed forward to the CDC by local departments of community health. They didn't come through any other forms of automated data systems. And if any of you have yourself listening have had COVID-19, you know you can expect a call from your Department of Community Health. Now, if you picked up the phone, they would ask you some information. Did you receive the vaccine? They'd ask you about contact tracing. But we know 70% of phone calls from people that we don't know on our phones, we don't answer. So we can imagine that the vast majority of cases that the Departments of Community Health call, nobody picks up the phone. But those who did, they were able to identify 10,000 breakthrough cases. So towards the end of April, you can imagine such a labor-intense process, the CDC announces on their website, we're no longer going to track breakthrough cases of COVID-19. So that was a de facto announcement that those who have been vaccinated, if they get COVID-19, they're not going to be reflected in any type of government data set. Now, we've had 400 million individuals, almost everybody on this listening group right now has had a COVID-19 test. And you know, when you take a COVID-19 test, no matter where you are, what is not put in the data with that lab test result is whether or not you've been previously vaccinated. Also, what's not put in there is whether or not you've had previously had COVID or COVID recovered. So the lab value goes into a central data set and is reported by Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. But the reporting on COVID-19 is not connected at all to whether or not someone's been vaccinated. So all we know is that some hospitals may have the ability to voluntarily report to the CDC patients who are admitted with COVID-19 and that have been previously vaccinated, but that is clearly a push forward voluntary effort. And so it's created a very important false talking point. And the false talking point is that this is a crisis of the unvaccinated. Of course it's not. We don't have the data showing all the vaccinated Americans who are getting COVID-19, nor do we have any type of capture of what's going on with respect to hospitalizations and deaths. Now, deaths will trail about 4 to 8 weeks after the hospitalizations. So this has created this talking point of you better hurry up and get vaccinated because this is a crisis of the unvaccinated. Well, you can imagine anybody attempting to get a vaccine now is going to basically easily be 4 to 8 weeks away from full protection from any effect that they're going to have of the vaccine. And now with the Delta Plus variant, it doesn't matter because the virus will attack anyway and the vaccine's going to have little effect. Well, as late as just a few hours ago, the talking points have shifted. And they've said, well, listen, you know, we know the vaccines weren't perfect and you could get COVID-19 anyway, but we know the vaccine is going to make your ride with COVID-19 easier and you're much less likely to have severe disease and much less likely to be hospitalized. And that's the reason to get the vaccine. And so the reason to get the vaccine is not just to avoid COVID-19, but to have this, if you will, freedom from severe complications of COVID-19. Well, there is a paper that's attempted to evaluate that, and the first author is Thompson, and it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and they compared individuals who are vaccinated to those who are unvaccinated, and they did fairly evaluate the course. So you get the first shot, then you have to wait for the second shot for the messenger RNA vaccines, or you get the first shot with Johnson & Johnson, and then you have to wait a longer period of time to get that first immunity. And then they did evaluate individuals that got COVID-19 in both the unvaccinated and vaccinated groups and made determinations about the severity of the illness. And what they described was that those, in fact, vaccinated had about a 40% lower what's called viral load. So it didn't protect individuals 100% from the virus. It just kind of cut down the viral load by about 40%. And when they evaluated how long they were sick, and it was predominantly a very younger group that had the illness, the vaccine resulted, fresh vaccination resulted in less sick days from 3.8 days to 1.5 days. That was Thompson in the New England Journal of Medicine. So we have a pretty good handle on this now, that if one were to rush out to get the vaccine, it could reduce the number of sick days by a few, no influence on hospitalization and death, and it looks like the vaccine would have no impact on the binary issue of whether or not you would get COVID-19. So with 67% of Americans over age 65 and about 50% of Americans overall having received the vaccine, what we're really down to is who hasn't received the vaccine. Well, many individuals may not have received the vaccine because they have natural immunity, and they recognize this in the studies, that natural immunity is robust, complete, durable. There's never been a bona fide second case of COVID-19 where we have really solid information on both episodes. I mean, patients with sick, with fever, loss of taste and smell, cough, upper respiratory symptoms, positive PCR antigen or now sequencing test on the first occasion, and then having about 90-day interval because we know the test can be positive easily for 90 days after the first episode, and the discrete second episode where, again, we have good documentation of the case. It's never been reported. There's about 100 or so in the literature that have attempted reported reinfection, and indeed, we can never seem to prove that reinfection can actually happen. In each and every case, it looks, by my evaluation, that on one of these occasions, it's just simply a positive, false positive nasal PCR test when the patient's not really sick. And with so much extra testing, we know that that is certainly possible. Now, it's helpful because as of June 25th, the World Health Organization has dropped any endorsement of asymptomatic testing. So we should have that out of the picture at this point in time. None of the tests, the PCR, antigen, or sequencing tests, were ever FDA approved or cleared for the use in asymptomatic individuals. They were only used as a diagnostic aid for those acutely sick and suspected COVID-19. That means all the routine testing done in college dorms, in the travel industry, to get on planes, to get into government buildings, other medical facilities, all that routine testing was completely off-label and completely unnecessary. And I can tell you that I have patients who are having elective surgeries, and they're telling me I have to get a COVID-19 test. This has happened in my family. I had a patient yesterday who says, you know, I'm flying internationally and I need to get a COVID-19 test. This is completely off-label It has no grounding in regulatory science, and it's advised against by the World Health Organization. It's come up countless times that the children could be forced to wear masks at school if they haven't taken the vaccine, or if even if they have taken the vaccine, given the current conditions. And what we have is this fear driving a reflex behavior in perseveration on masks. And since we have two very good studies, one by Cao and one by Madewell, that have demonstrated that asymptomatic spread is really negligible, that we can come up with a much more reasonable strategy of what to do at school. I can tell you, if I was a school administrator, I would just be vigilant on my sick child policy. That means if a child is sick, we certainly don't want that child showing up to work or showing up to school, and we don't want a child who becomes sick during the course of a day to stay in the classroom for another half a day. So we need protocols and careful instructions to parents and flexibility by schools, employers. We even need flexibility by the travel industry that if an individual becomes sick, that they need to be able to withdraw themselves or get withdrawn out of a congregate setting like a school classroom, go home. If we're going to put a mask on anybody, at least for a short period of time, let's put a mask on the acutely sick kid, get them away from others, get them home into self-quarantine or family quarantine and not expose others. That's much more reasonable than trying to make everybody wear masks and struggle with it. So we need protocols for sick kids. We need flexibility for sick employees. And even among family members, we need an inventory on who's naturally immune with COVID-19. This happened in my practice just yesterday. I got a call from one of my patients who said the entire family has COVID-19. I said, well, who do you have at home? Well, we have parents and we have two kids. And I said, well, who's sick? And she gave me the list. And then I said, well, who has had COVID-19 and who's naturally immune? And I think it was the mother who said, well, I've had COVID-19 and I got through it last year. I said, fine. Well, you're fine. You can go out to the store. You can get medications. You can do other things. You can go to work. And the people who are not, they're going to have to stay at home. Once there's a sick person in the house, there's about an 85% chance it's going to spread to the susceptible people in the house. It won't spread to the non-susceptible. So even within family members and family groups, we need to understand who is naturally immune to COVID-19. It's something you don't hear on the news at all. It's the only practical thing we can do. And I can tell you, as a doctor, that's what I'm asking about in my clinical practice. I'm asking practical things like that. Who has natural immunity? If there's any questions regarding this, I offer to order an antibody test, the high-quality antibody test, Quest, Roche, Abbott, Ortho Clinical Diagnostics. If they are positive, that means that an individual has hit a sufficiently high level on the antibody titer, about the same level as a positive control who's been sick in the hospital or the ICU. That is a sufficient piece of information to indicate prior infection and complete, robust, and durable immunity. If they haven't hit the antibody level, but in fact they've had COVID-19, just never got the PCR or antigen test, and it's still unclear, individuals at their own expense can order the T-Detect test. That you can go to the website T-Detect and fill out the information online and then go ahead and pay the fee for the test. The lab director for T-Detect approves it, and then one goes to a local laboratory, and the laboratory that they offer is LabCorp, and they have offices all over the United States, and get your blood drawn. That uses next-generation sequencing, looking for minor chromosomal rearrangements on chromosomes that code for T-cell receptors that have been altered because of COVID-19. In fact, the body is showing that the body is primed to recognize SARS-CoV-2, the virus, and then mount an immune response. There are studies showing that even if the antibodies have waned, and they do over time, that the bone marrow is ready to respond with plasma cells if COVID-19 is comes into exposure of that individual again for a second time. So our immune system has thousands of changes. This has been reviewed many times. We know that the vaccine is very limited. There's a limited library of antibodies against the spike protein. Natural immunity has a massive number of antibodies against the spike protein, but also the nucleocapsid, other targets within the virus, has robust T helper, T antigen presenting cells, natural killer cells, thousands of changes in the T cells, and that's what makes the natural immunity so robust. Now, there is a great fear again rising over the United States, and as many of you know, I am commonly called to appear on Fox News, the Ingram Angle, and give my opinion over what's going on in the pandemic, and I just want to play this clip for you, and this was done late last night.
Joining us now is Dr. Peter McCullough, internist, cardiologist, epidemiologist, and professor of medicine at Texas A&M. Dr. McCullough, your reaction.
Well, things have really dramatically changed, and very quickly, last time I was on, we were at 30% Delta variant. Well, right now, as of July 17th, we're at 83% Delta variant. It's a completely different viral syndrome. It's much more mild. I'd expect that we would manage right through it. We are about 10% of our peak back in December, so we're having a mild outbreak at this point in time. We'll be able to treat our way through it. I don't think we have any need for drastic measures at this point.
And the Biden administration last night, still no talk of natural or adaptive immunity from those who have been previously exposed to the virus. Why?
Well, you know, natural immunity is our backstop, and we know 25% of people who took the vaccine, they actually had natural immunity. They were needlessly vaccinated, but it's still the backstop. If anybody really wants to take an inventory in terms of their employees, especially small businesses, they should know who has natural immunity, who's had the virus. Those are the individuals who are fully protected.
Dr. McCullough, as always, a voice of reason and calm.
You can hear the tone of that. It's sometimes I feel that I'm called to speak to the nation, really to settle us down and utilize the science. And notice that I'm pinpoint with respect to these references. I am not freewheeling much in terms of my opinions on things. I am pinpoint with the references. People have asked me, they've said, Dr. McCullough, aren't you afraid? Aren't you being attacked by individuals? And I always respond, and people are so miffed by this, I've actually never been attacked or confronted on a single point that I've made because I am so evidence-based. I just anchor it right to the medical literature. And if you hear individuals commenting and pundits commenting on COVID-19, but they are not mentioning the first author or even where the manuscript appears or where it's published, that means there's no anchor to what they're saying. There may be actually no evidence behind what one is saying. And you can hear me each and every time anchor my what's called inferences, my conclusions of what I'm interpreting in the literature. And that is a position of strength. And I can tell you historically, I'm looking at this and I do not want to land on the wrong side of history. And I don't want people recording my name and playing it months or years later and say, look how wrong Dr. McCullough was. And so I've been very careful about this. I published an entire series last year in the journal The Hill, where I predicted every twist and turn of the pandemic, and fortunately, correctly, and I was forecasting for Americans of the readership of The Hill. And I've done the same thing for the listenership of America Out Loud, the McCullough Report, to give you the most accurate view and forecast of what's going on. I'm going to forecast that we're going to continue to have a rise of Delta cases or the Delta Plus, and we understand that this is going to impact roughly, there'll be an equal proportion of those vaccinated or unvaccinated. It will become finally understood by America that the vaccines have failed on Delta, and the proposition will be, will the vaccine program ultimately be closed down because it doesn't work? It doesn't work enough. It has many issues on safety that we've highlighted time and time again. Or is it going to push forward and are people going to feel increasingly uncomfortable on the COVID-19 vaccine, be taking it for social reasons or because of mandates or because of family pressure? And are the injuries going to continue to mount with the vaccine? So we'll keep you updated on this. I tell you, the tension in America right now, you can almost cut it with a knife. And sometimes I just want to go on national TV and help settle down the nation, help us get back to work. We're at a low from a very low baseline. We're having a small outbreak at this point in time. It's easily manageable, easily treatable. High-risk patients still need early ambulatory treatment. Highest-risk seniors need an antibody infusion. We have the Regeneron antibody. It still seems to work fine in Delta. We're using our sequence multi-drug approach. We're tending to favor ivermectin-based protocols based on experiences from India and some of our experiences here in the United States. And then we sequence through our other drugs that work just fine in COVID-19. I just did this for a couple, an elderly senior couple in my practice. One of the individuals in the couple, the wife, she had had the vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, fully vaccinated. The husband didn't. And they both came down with COVID at the same time. And I treated them the same way. It took about 10 days, but they got through the illness just fine. So we'll end on that happy note. I've got a terrific show today. I have one guest, but she's worth it, Dr. Jane Ruby. Dr. Jane Ruby is a nurse practitioner, a psychologist, a licensed practicing healthcare professional. She's got a great story as a COVID-19 patient herself and then becoming an activist. She's also a media star, so many of you who are following this story will recognize Dr. Jane Ruby. She is a dynamo, terrific lady, and you're going to enjoy the back half of the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. Looking for better sleep, focus, and energy? Check out Healthy Cell, the leading innovator in nutritional supplements for cell health. Boost your short-term focus and long-term brain power with Healthy Cell's Focus and Recall Vitamins. That's the one I'm going to take today. I'm on a short sleep cycle right now, and I need as much focus and brain power today to get through the rest of my week. Go to HealthyCell.com and use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, for a 20% off your first order of any product.
Because of COVID-19, the average American worries about their immune health 4 times a day. That's 112 times per year. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains 15 full doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day pill-free gel pack. It tastes great, is convenient on the go, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
While the cancel culture is determined to destroy our history, bringing violence and terror to city streets, America Out Loud will enhance its own message of love and honor for the American traditions and constitutional values that have always been the backbone of what America means: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. And I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. It's my great pleasure to welcome to the show Dr. Jane Ruby. Dr. Ruby received her bachelor's degree from Alfred University and then went on to the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York, and received her master's degree in nursing, went on there to complete a PhD in psychology, and then had additional studies later on in her career at the Barcelona School of Management, where she received a degree in international business. And Dr. Ruby has really been active in the COVID-19 pandemic, really driven by her deep pharmaceutical development experience. She had worked from about 5 pharmaceutical companies and really have been involved in the development of some blockbuster drugs that are used common everyday names in medicine.
Additionally, she had her own radio show in D.C. called Dr. Jane D.C., and this was a political conservative radio show. So she was uniquely positioned with her biotech pharma development, as well as her experience in the media, to come on the scenes and really help Americans understand COVID-19 and this really terribly confusing literature that was coming forward, as well as a narrative from public agencies, et cetera. I learned about Dr. Jane Ruby because people kept bringing me to her interviews with Stu Peters. And these were some of the best evidence-based, insightful interviews that I've seen throughout the pandemic. So it's my great pleasure to welcome to the show, Dr. Ruby. Welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thank you, Dr. McCullough. It's just a pleasure to be with you this evening.
Well, why don't you further introduce yourself to the listeners and let us know, how did you take up a passion for COVID-19?
Well, unfortunately, sometimes a tragedy can be a blessing, but unfortunately in March of 2020, I came down with a flu-like symptoms, and I was sent to one of those drive-in testing sites, and my doctor called me 10 days later to advise me that I was COVID positive. I really didn't know what that meant at the time. For me, it was a rough experience in that it was a flu. It's a very, you know, very aggressive symptoms and very typical though. And about halfway through, first I asked the doctor if he would just prescribe the HCQ, the hydroxychloroquine. I said, you know, I have the infection, and he refused to do it, which was very strange. I had a good working relationship with my doctor, and then I had an occasion to go to the hospital on the encouragement of friends and family. They were afraid that I had a pneumonia, but that I didn't know about it. So I went to the hospital, went through the emergency room. They did do a chest x-ray. It was clear, thank God. However, I tried to get the hydroxychloroquine there too. And they told me that they couldn't do that unless I was on a ventilator already. And I said, well, why would you wait till I was that bad? So after that, Dr. McCullough, I actually did some digging when I went back home. I couldn't understand why people wouldn't give me something that was safe and effective. I knew it as a nurse practitioner. I knew it was safe. It had been out for years. And I started doing some digging, and I found that, unfortunately, it was divided state by state according to partisan lines. In other words, if you lived in a state that was predominantly run by or had a left-wing, Democrat governor, through the State Department of Health, they were blocking access to HCQ. And I thought even that was strange, and they all used similar language in their state edicts. And so I went and I just kind of made a list, both sides, and I found that that the Republican states were not blocking. So I thought that was just such a strange thing. And that's when it just sort of tipped me off that this is really a political issue. It's something bigger than what we thought. And from there, I started doing some interviews, believe it or not, from my recovery bed to explain to people what was happening and alert them that it could actually be dangerous to live in a state where your governor is blocking access to, at the time, what we knew was the only best early treatment for the infection.
Did you ultimately get hydroxychloroquine?
I never did. In fact, my doctor's parting words on the phone to me were, Jane, you're just going to have to tough this one out. I just couldn't, in retrospect, I think it's incredibly reprehensible. I'm lucky I didn't go into a flash pneumonia or any other pulmonary crisis. But it just showed me how dangerous it was, to be in a state where the governor is blocking access to drugs.
Now, did you get any treatment at all?
Well, I did go around the doctor, and I begged his nurse practitioner for a prescription for azithromycin because I knew it had a secondary effect to protect my lungs. And I actually walked 3 blocks, sick as a dog with a fever of 103, to the local drugstore to pick it up because I was afraid if they delivered it, they would lose it and I wouldn't get it. And I just felt it was going to be life. If it was the only thing I could get, it could be life-saving.
Boy, and that story was back in March, and really we've come a long way now. There was a paper published in Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine, and the first author's last name is Barry. And to support what you're saying is he evaluated the literature, and he found that papers that tended to try to knock down hydroxychloroquine, say it was unsafe or say it was ineffective, they actually were published by doctors who had Democratic voting records. And so he actually showed political bias in the time of the literature. And this is before we had a lot of data that came in on hydroxychloroquine. And boy, were you right. 300 supportive studies now. All the outpatient randomized trials stopped early in an analysis by Ladapo and colleagues, showed about a 24% reduction in events. Large observational studies, one from Iran, 30,000 patients, 25% of them treated with hydroxychloroquine, 50% reductions in hospitalizations and death. Hydroxychloroquine can reduce the duration of symptoms and viral shedding from about 14 days to 4 days, and a really valuable drug in our armamentarium. Well, geez, sure. you were a patient yourself. You were mm-hmm. denied treatment, and it sounded like you went on a tear to try to be sure that this didn't happen to others.
Yeah, and I dug even further, Dr. McCullough, and I looked through. It just didn't make sense to me, even though I was seeing it in front of me across all these different states. And I found out later on that they basically had to disparage the existing treatments, as you probably well know by now, because the FDA would never have been able to go forward with an emergency use authorization in the presence of existing safe and effective treatments. So this was the scam behind bashing and blocking access to hydroxychloroquine and subsequently ivermectin.
Well, take it from there. You've done tremendous work, and I think one of the big areas you've contributed to is vaccine safety, and what are the implications in the workplace in a variety of occupations?
Well, in terms of when you say safety, to me as someone who's been involved in pharmaceutical drug development for almost 20 years, there's a very predictable pattern. It's a regulatorily driven required pattern for development, and it's different stages of safety, establishing safety before you go on to test medications in human beings. And so when we talk about safety, I mean, what shocked me and what got me involved in speaking out even more was that I was watching before my eyes a lot of these processes that are driven by regulatory requirements just like not in existence, not happening. In fact, there's still no safety oversight. There's no reporting back by the company, checking follow-up with patients who have taken these jabs. There's no return of the information on safety. The only place we're getting safety is social media and these self-reporting systems like VAERS. So look, and I tell a story, Dr. McCullough, that in the earlier days, my early days of starting with drug research, in the pharma industry, the very famous drug Celexa, which is no longer, I mean, it's still around, but when it was in development, it was going through preclinical trials, and it's tested through different species of animals and then breeds within those species. Six beagle dogs died, and that study was shut down. It hadn't even gotten to human beings yet. And what they did was they demanded that the company, the FDA demanded that the company isolate the reason why before they could go forward with it in human beings. What they found was that it was an anomaly specific to not only dogs, but that breed of dog. And then so a couple of years later, after they established that and got their okay again, they were able to proceed in humans. And actually, luckily, everything went well in humans. But my point is that study was shut down. That was a billion-dollar drug, okay, that went on to make $1 billion a year for all of its lifespan. So that was, you know, not messing around with something insignificant. We shut down an entire study because six beagle dogs had a heart attack. We now have, God, I don't know, Dr. McCullough, we could be looking at 40,000, 50,000, who knows with the, you know, with the accuracy or the self-reported inaccuracies of the VAERS system. We have tens of thousands of Americans, just Americans, who have died. And just today, I understand the CDC like sort of released the floodgates on a bunch of many more deaths. And I'm just saying to myself, where is the threshold to shut this down?
Well, you know, I looked at the data and I thought around January 22nd, I presented to key leaders in Washington. I missed it, but the safety signal actually was exceeded at that time. We had 186 deaths. That was far beyond a confidence interval that we would have seen for the annual number of deaths between 150 and 175. And so if we had a day safety monitoring board on this program, which should be for all large investigations, I've done a ton of that work myself, it would have been shut down in February. But we have not had a single press briefing on product safety to Americans. Mm-hmm. So we're asking Americans to take these injections with no press briefings and no updates on product safety. What's going on, Dr. Ruby?
Well, I don't like to get into conspiracies and things like that, although I think at this point, I have to say, we have seen more than enough evidence. to make a determination that this is unsafe for humans. And the other concern I have is that not only are doctors and other health providers in lockstep, this strange trance where they're just telling the public, this is safe for everyone, it's safe for babies, fetuses, pregnant women, people with autoimmune disorder. Nothing in the planet is safe for every population, 100%. So something else is going on here. I don't know what it is, but I'm very concerned about it. And I think it's bigger than just any one pharmaceutical company or any one, you know, a politician or any government. And I'm very worried. I'm very worried where this thing is going to end up.
You know, it's true that it's worldwide. Whatever's going on is worldwide. And you can see a fracturing of opinions on things. So, for instance, there could be a country like Israel where they have 80% adult vaccination rates. Okay, Israel's pretty, you know, modern, contemporary country. I've been there a couple of times myself. Go over to Japan, 18% vaccination rate. Mm. Let me give you another example. United States pushing hard to vaccinate children. United Kingdom? No, we're not going to vaccinate children. Germany, no, leave the kids out of it. So we're seeing fractured patterns. Let me mm-hmm. give you another example. We have North Carolina that is saying vaccination is so important that children in school down to age 12 ought to be able to consent themselves to get the vaccine. Mm. Go over to Ohio, and Ohio says no vaccine mandates. For colleges across the board. Go over to Indiana. Indiana University says, vaccinate all the college students, court case, and the court says, go ahead and vaccinate them. So we have an incredible array of disparate, mm-hmm. that should tell the listeners something is wrong. There isn't agreement.
That's true. There is not agreement, although there is an overall push in many different, you asked me about workplaces earlier. There's a big push across different types of industries that's very strange. Hospital systems, as you know, airlines. We get a lot of internal documents and we get a lot of whistleblowing materials from some of these industries where the people like pilots and flight attendants, for example, in the airline industry are saying they've never seen anything like it. They don't understand. And the whole thing to me is so bizarre because to be honest with you, not only do we have effective treatments for whatever this virus was that burst out last year, but it's burned down for the most part. I don't believe in the variants. That's just my personal opinion. I believe viruses burn down, not up. And I just think they're arbitrarily naming different things. Maybe we have cycles. You know, there are other organisms in the world. And we've never lived in a sterile world before. I try to remind people. We live in a sea of fungus and bacteria and virus and protozoa and things like that. And for the most part, we do pretty well. We're talking about a status post virus or flu of whatever origin that is not even really, in my mind, around anymore. And something very disturbing happened today. I saw a report where a video clip of Governor Ron DeSantis, who declared that the only people that are in the hospitals right now in Florida that are sick are the unvaccinated. And I'm not sure where he's getting his information, but we have inside information and we live here in the state of Florida, and that is not what we're seeing. We're seeing that the vaccinated are actually vaccine injured and they are COVID-like sick. So I don't know if there was something in their inoculations that, you know, created symptoms similar to a flu, but and of course we know we can't trust the PCR test. So what are they really measuring and what are they using to measure it? It's just confusing.
It's called asymmetric reporting, and we kind of cracked the case on this one. The CDC said by the end of May they're no longer going to report COVID-19 in the community in vaccinated patients. Why? Because the only way they can find out about it is local departments of community health that pushed cases forward to the CDC and said, listen, we have a breakthrough case. And they had to vet it, make sure the patient was fully vaccinated, what have you. And in fact, the CDC at 10,000 cases where 9% were hospitalized, 3% died, the CDC said, listen, we give up. We're no longer going to track this problem. The data feed that comes from the laboratories into the Johns Hopkins Center on the PCR test or the antigen test, those data feeds, Those data feeds do not have vaccination status. They can't. They are simply a laboratory electronic connection and interface. They don't have the patients. When someone gets a PCR test, there isn't a field for vaccination. So what's happening is there is an assumption that's been made based at the end of May that they're all unvaccinated. And that became a storyline. The only way that the CDC could actually identify a vaccinated patient who got COVID-19, if for some reason through their hospital systems, which are incomplete, there's only a couple hundred hospitals that are participating in CDC data, if they happen to tell them. So they've created an automatic talking point that 99% of people hospitalized or with COVID-19 are unvaccinated. And yesterday on the news cycle, they must have had 16 different people in the administration say, this is a crisis of the unvaccinated. I'm sure they told DeSantis to say the same thing. That's not the case whatsoever. We know from Israel, we have 80% of patients with COVID-19 were previously vaccinated. We know 40% in the UK with COVID-19 previously vaccinated. In my practice in Dallas right now, I've just had a big flurry of cases. I'm keeping in close touch with Yvette Lozano, who runs an exclusive outpatient COVID-19 treatment program. And the answer is about half of Americans who have COVID-19 right now have been previously vaccinated, i.e. the vaccines are failing in terms of efficacy.
Yes, yes. How are we going to get that message out? I mean, thank God for what the work you're doing. But in general, how do we overcome that? How do you get that kind of information to somebody like Governor DeSantis, who's one of the, you know, only holdouts or hopefuls in the country to keep our country open and free? I'm just worried that he's going to get either schnookered or flipped or something.
Well, I had emergency calls this morning on this because we saw the talking points. We're trying to do the best we can in the media. But as you know, it's very difficult when we go on Fox News or we go on Newsmax or the rest of these stations, our listeners are very small. There's only a couple million people nowadays who watch TV. People get their information through other sources. Maybe this, I know Stu Peters and your great work also gets a lot of viewership, but we've got to get the message out that this is intentional asymmetric reporting in order to make it look like the unvaccinated are the problem in order to promote continued mass vaccination on people who don't want it. We're at the point where 50% of the country has taken the vaccine, most of them December, January, February, before we know about the safety data. Now we have a lot of regretful people. The vaccination centers started clearing out in April. Ours has been empty for months. I drew past it today, empty. They have the barricades up. People haven't gotten a vaccine at our center in at least a couple months. The point is, everybody who's gotten the vaccine, who wanted it, got it. The other half of the nation who doesn't want it, they don't want it. They don't want it. And they've gotten the message. They're either afraid of it. They've been COVID recovered. They know they can't benefit. They're pregnant, women at childbearing potential, blood disorders, other contraindications, blood clotting disorders. And so we're really stuck now. We're typical America, 50-50. You've been a political analyst. You know, we're a 50-50 country. And now we're starting to see this tension built. The CDC says the program is investigational and elective. The CDC says it should not be mandated. So everybody who's coming up with a vaccine mandate right now is really kind of going above and beyond even the CDC guidance.
Yes, yes. It concerns me because, and I'm praying that number of 50% is accurate, because we're going to need at least 50% of the country to protect the country once they start to clamp down. And once these 50% that were inoculated start to manifest some of the further illnesses from these, you know, these mRNA injections with their, you know, prolific spike protein toxicity. So we'll have to see what happens there. But it's just every day is a new source of anxiety, I have to tell you. Keeping God at the forefront, because I just don't know what else to do. You know, we just have to keep getting the word out and tell people that really the window is closing. I want people to know that before we sort of say goodnight now, that the window is closing. The time is now. To get back into your local governments, you know, push back on these restrictions. And it's time for everybody to stand up, because we're not going to have any room to do so once they push this forward, I'm afraid.
I agree. In the last few minutes, can we turn our attention to this issue of blood clotting? I think you, out of anybody in the kind of the health information field, has opened our eyes to the risks of the vaccine and the development of blood clots afterwards. What brief update do you have for us?
Well, I'm just still putting pieces together. I think we know that with so many cases of blood clots, whether they end up in someone's heart or lungs, or brain determines whether they have a stroke or a heart attack or a pulmonary fatality. And we're putting these together. So we're seeing, we're assuming that either the lipid nanoparticle is toxic, or it's just because it's a nanoparticle, it can get into so much more of the body than regular size molecules, and that maybe it's disrupting. We know from some of the preclinical work that a lot of the material ends up, especially the spike proteins that eventually emanate from the mRNA directions to the cells to make it, we know that a lot of it ends up in certain organs, including and body parts like the bone marrow. There's a certain affinity for platelets, your clotting cells, so it messes with them on both ends, where you either could, have that syndrome where you're bleeding and clotting at the same time, or just throwing clots. And so we also know that they concentrate in the ovaries, and I think we got that, speaking of Israel, from the Israeli experience, since they were so vaccinated, and I pray that they have not sterilized, the majority of their childbearing women in their country, because that could be the end of the country in another generation. But we know that they do park themselves heavily in the ovaries. And in fact, they filed a study on clinicaltrials.gov, the Sheba, I think it's called Beth Sheba Hospital, and it's not affiliated with any pharmaceutical company, which was a relief. And it's called the Ovarian Reserve Study. So if you go to clinicaltrials.gov and put in Ovarian Reserve, you will see that study. They're going to look at 200 women who got the jab, 200 who didn't, and they're going to test their ovarian reserve. I believe it's through hormonal, serum hormones, and maybe there are some other tests involved. But I can't wait to see what the results are for that, to see if they really did knock out a lot of, fertility in their country. Could be crazy.
Well, we'll have to see what it shows. We know there's been some studies that really meant to reassure people. I saw one in JAMA, believe it or not, regarding sperm counts after vaccination. It was a small number of subjects, but actually the report was the sperm counts went up. And, it's hard to know, but there's great concern. Your work has been terrific. And we are going to go ahead and close out the interview. Do you have any final words for the McCullough Report audience?
Well, I want to thank you for having me. It's been an honor. You've been one of my mentors at a distance until we met, and you've taught me a lot, and I'm just glad you're on the forefront. So it's an honor to be here with you tonight. And I just want the audience to know that, we can overcome this. I do believe this in my heart, but it's going to take all of us, and it's going to take all of us to, start at our local levels, coalesce in your neighborhoods, put up barrier signs, don't let those Biden, vax visitors come by. Do it as a group so that not one family or person gets targeted, and just and get together and start to think about the things you can do. Plan, prep, and pray, I would say.
Wow, those are some dark words, Dr. Ruby, but we'll let those be the last words. Thank you for joining us on the McCullough Report.
Thanks so much, Dr. McCullough. My pleasure.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.